Today is Thursday, May 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Attorney General says he won't testify to Congress Thursday due to the terms of the hearing. As hate crimes rise around the world, International Holocaust Day is seen as a stark reminder.
In remembering the Holocaust, the next words that should come to mind is never again. And never again is not about just the Jewish people. It's really that this kind of act of genocide should never be perpetrated against any people.
Also ahead, a reunited pop band planning a big tour with the release of a new album. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, defying the U.S. Congress, Attorney General William Barr will not attend a House Judiciary Committee hearing Thursday on his handling of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report. Chairman Gerald Nadler then accused Barr of being afraid to testify. The notification followed a contentious Senate hearing earlier in the day on Wednesday, where Barr defended his treatment of the report. VOA's Michael Bowman has more from Capitol Hill.
The man who shaped the public's first impressions of the Mueller report came face to face with Senate Democrats. They accused Attorney General Barr of spinning the report to benefit President Donald Trump.
You used every advantage of your office to create the impression that the president was cleared of misconduct. You put the power and authority of the Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice behind a public relations effort to help Donald Trump protect himself.
Trump himself claimed complete exoneration in the Russia probe after Barr's summary letter. Then came the release of the report itself, which detailed numerous legally dubious actions by Trump and his inner circle. Revealed this week, a letter Mueller wrote to Barr alleging the Attorney General's initial summary was incomplete and sparked public confusion about the results of the Russia probe.
You announced that you had cleared the president 25 days before the public could read the Mueller report for themselves. I think it's no wonder Special Counsel Mueller thought your four-page letter created public confusion.
Barr insisted he was focused on the Mueller report's bottom line, which was mostly favorable to Trump, no documented collusion with Russia, and insufficient evidence that the president obstructed justice.
I made the determination that we had to put out some information about the bottom line. The body politic was in a high state of agitation. There was massive interest in learning what the bottom line results of Bob Mueller's investigation was, particularly as to collusion.
Barr added that he ultimately nullified Mueller's concerns by releasing the special counsel's report, including numerous portions unflattering to the president. Republicans, meanwhile, argued the attorney general had a duty to lift a cloud of legal doubt that had hovered over Trump for years.
Time and time again, the president's political adversaries have exploited the Mueller probe, its mere existence, to spread baseless innuendo in an effort to undermine the legitimacy of the 2016 election.
Democrats noted that in previous testimony, Barr denied that Mueller's team had objected to his summary letter. Barr responded that Mueller told him directly that he was more concerned with the news media's handling of Barr's summary than with the summary itself.
Well, the hearing marked the first time a member of the Trump administration testified about the contents of Mueller's report, which detailed extensive contacts between Trump's campaign and Moscow and the campaign's expectations that it would benefit from Russia's actions. Joining us now to talk more about it is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs is Bob Deitz. What's your initial reaction to Wednesday's Senate hearing with the Attorney General?
I think many Americans would be disappointed. I know I am, because I thought that what Attorney General Barr laid bare was that he was really acting as President Trump's attorney and not as the Attorney General of the United States. And I feel personally really disappointed in that, but I don't see how one can reach any other conclusion watching him testify. His evasions, nitpicking language, and so forth. And I think this was also laid bare in the letter that Mr. Mueller sent to him concerning his four-page summary.
He seemed to downplay Mr. Mueller in general, saying he thought the letter that Mr. Mueller sent, sort of disputing the way he presented the report, was snitty.
that's the sort of comment that one makes when one realizes he just lost an argument.
He was asked if he believes on a moral level, even if it's the criminal part of telling your White House attorney to fire Mueller or to let him go. And he said, well, he didn't fire him. He just tried to remove him, and it wasn't a crime. And he really wouldn't basic answer to the question of whether the standard is now only if it's a president committing a crime.
Was it the right thing to do? That's part of what I meant earlier when I said I found it disappointing, and I think others would as well. As you're aware from prior conversations, I have worked with Mr. Barr, and I always found him to be an upstanding, honest, straightforward, and I think he was everything but that in his testimony. And I also thought he looked pretty uncomfortable at parts of it, really as though he were acting as a defense attorney where you're, you know, parsing language really closely.
The Republicans seem to unanimously want to just say case closed as far as the Mueller report. The chair of the committee, Lindsey Graham, said as far as he was concerned, this issue is done. Others, including Mr. Graham, wanted to talk about Hillary Clinton's emails and opening up investigations into Clinton and also investigate how this whole Mueller investigation started.
Well, I mean, look, if you're losing a game, the best thing you can do is say, let's change games. I don't know how this is going to play. I think certainly the Trump hardcore supporters will say, yeah, let's move on to, you know, Hillary. But I think many people who are less partisan might say, we aren't really done, and let's probe more deeply into the Mueller report.
Well, speaking of the Mueller report, we have learned that Attorney General Barr says he will not comply with a request from the House for the full unredacted Mueller report.
Yes.
What's going on here?
Well, I think that the Democrats are on weaker ground. There are things that are in the Mueller report that derive directly or come directly from the grand jury. It is a traditional rule. I think it's really more than a rule, a strong principle that you do not reveal grand jury information to the public or to Capitol Hill for that matter. And so I think they're on weaker ground there, and I think a court might well deny a contempt citation.
He also said he's not going to attend a hearing that he said he would with the House.
Yes.
Because they said they would have attorneys in there as well.
Yes.
That will be asking questions, and he will not answer questions with attorneys. Why are they trying so hard not to just be truthful?
Oh, look, attorneys are trained to do close cross-examination. And if the attorney general starts parsing phrases, parsing words, and sort of basically playing, pardon the expression, but playing dumb, an attorney's going to know how to play that and will really make him look weak. If you recall, well, this is probably before your time, but the Watergate investigation on the Hill was led by attorneys, and one of them was a former prosecutor. And so they know how to handle recalcitrant witnesses. And that's, I'm sure, why Mr. Barr doesn't want to face that kind of withering questions, which would make him look at worst like a liar, probably at best make him look disingenuous.
Will the public, will Congress ever know the full scope and truth about this report?
Yes, I think they will. As you, I'm sure, have seen, newspapers have not stopped reporting on this even just because the report is now out. They are digging below the surface to find out sort of what informed various judgments. And I think that both the Times and the Post, the Wall Street Journal, and others are going to keep digging to find out everything that's not in the Mueller report but may have been known to the Mueller team.
All right, that's George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Bob Deitz. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. is prepared for military intervention in Venezuela. A teenage migrant dies in a Texas hospital while in U.S. custody. Growing concerns over Saudi Arabia's rights abuses. And China's economic outreach in Latin America is drawing U.S. concern. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. As the May 8th general election approaches, many South African voters say they are cynical and fed up with the longtime ruling African National Congress. As South Africa marks 25 years of ANC rule, that sentiment appears to have spread to the areas the ANC has long considered safe, the countryside. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Many are turning to opposition parties like the Democratic Alliance or the Economic Freedom Fighters. But many others are simply staying away. In a small maize farming town of Volmaranstad, unemployed voter Tsepo Mosweu says he has lost hope that the ANC will bring improvements since the death of ANC icon Nelson Mandela.
And I do have hope that sooner or later the oppositions will also take power here in Bloemhof.
Will that happen? Or will the rural areas stand by the ruling party? South Africa finds out on May 8th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Northern Cape, South Africa.
American and Chinese trade negotiators met on Wednesday for talks on an ongoing trade war, as Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said they could be getting closer to a deal and that the talks were productive. Both governments say they are making progress, and that helped calm the financial markets. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Jeffrey Moon, former trade representative with the Obama administration and currently an international trade consultant, if the talks in Beijing really could be progressing, or if it's all just for show.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. These officials are all professionals that have been doing international business transactions for a long time, and they know how to project appropriate optimism, which their governments want to project. Both President Trump has certainly signaled that he wants a deal, so I think that's the basis for optimism. And the consistent statements from both sides suggest that there's going to be progress as well.
What does it take, and what is it taking for a deal to be completed?
Well, there are a variety of issues that are out there on the table. There are purchases to reduce the trade deficit. There are market openings the U.S. is seeking, changes in China's industrial policy reforms. And then, of course, there's enforcement on any agreements that are there. So there are a number of issues that are out there. I think that they have made a lot of progress on purchases, not so much on market openings. A lot remains to be discussed about industrial policy reforms. And most of the press attention and a lot of attention of the negotiators is on enforcement. Not entirely clear what it is they're going to be enforcing, but they've been talking about a mechanism and consequences for enforcing things.
Well, you know, officials and businesses, they say China's failed to keep past promises concerning its trade practices. Is that still the number one worry that is on their minds?
Well, in my mind, we need to have commitments to enforce. So what's most important is that we get China to change some policies and behaviors. However, given our past experience, enforcement is important. And enforcement, in my mind, needs to consist of three elements. There needs to be a mechanism, there need to be benchmarks for measuring things, and there need to be consequences. As for benchmarks, we really can't know what the benchmarks are until we know what the commitments are. And then in terms of consequences, President Trump has been very interested in tariffs and has thought that that is a very persuasive mechanism. The big question is when and how the tariffs will be removed. U.S. negotiators are focusing on that because of President Trump's priority. But for China, the tariffs are important, too. That's the only thing that they actually get out of these talks is removing those tariffs. So the options are to remove the tariffs in phases or reduce the percentage value of the tariffs that are out there. And these are the points that are being discussed right now. There are some press reports that they've reached an agreement, but there are no official statements.
So in your view and your estimation, how long is this going to take?
I think certainly there's going to be another round next week, and then there will at a minimum be a few weeks more of negotiations. It will take time to prepare the papers involved. It's a 150-page document. I think that the most optimistic deadline would be at the end of June, when there's going to be a G20 summit in Japan, and President Trump and Xi are going to be there. But President Trump has suggested that he would like to have a signing ceremony in the U.S. So I think it's going to take a while, and exactly where the signing will be is up in the air.
We've been talking with Jeff Moon. He was Assistant Trade Representative in the Obama administration. He's now an international trade consultant. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, fighting continues into its fourth week in the Libyan capital, and the war has now become a violent standoff. But with tens of thousands of people displaced, local aid workers say they don't have the capacity to take care of families if the war expands. And soldiers in Tripoli say there is currently no viable military solution that doesn't put the population in widespread danger. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Tripoli, Libya.
For almost a month now, there has been almost constant fighting in the suburbs surrounding the Libyan capital. And soldiers say neither side is advancing.
Behind me here is the front line, where fighters from the Western government of Tripoli are battling with fighters of Khalifa Haftar, the strongman who is the de facto leader of the East.
Since then, 42,000 people have been displaced, and UNICEF warns that more than 500,000 children are at risk if the battle continues.
Sometimes I am so scared I cannot talk or do anything. My little brother also sometimes can't talk. My mom tries to explain to him, but he is very scared.
Many families are hiding in their homes, afraid to leave. And as the battle drags on, aid workers say resources are growing thin.
We are very afraid of a large displacement of people because we have low capacities. We are dependent on the people and business people of Tripoli to help the families. So we fear we will not get enough support.
Before this fight began, many Libyan leaders had high hopes for peace talks that were scheduled in April. But these were canceled because of Haftar's attack on Tripoli.
The Western region was so close to becoming calm, peaceful, and secure before the war began. This war will bring destruction and instability, and it is very difficult to bring it to an end.
Tripoli has seen several wars since 2011, when a mass uprising overthrew another strongman, Muammar Gaddafi.
Soldiers and analysts say the only way to end this conflict is negotiations. There is no military solution. Reporting from the suburbs of Tripoli, I'm Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Well, today, May 2nd, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day many see as a reminder to never forget. But it also comes as the world is seeing a rise in anti-Semitism. Rabbi Terry Buchman, who has visited the Holocaust Museum in Kigali, Rwanda, and he is also the author of the book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. He joins us now. Rabbi, what's the most important message as you see it for this year's Holocaust Remembrance Day?
When it was decided that there would be a special day for Holocaust Memorial, it wasn't a unanimous feeling in the Jewish world. There was a kind of a split. Some felt that it should be put on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, where we commemorate the destruction of the temple and other horrible things, as one of a series of things that happened to the Jewish people. And others felt that the enormity, the numbers were so great that it needed its own special day. And so that latter feeling won out.
And there are very few survivors left now, so I would think that that would sort of add even more importance to taking a day to think about it and remember it, although there are certainly descendants of the Holocaust, not too many left that lived through it.
Judaism is bound up with memory. It's a thread that weaves its way through a lot. We are commanded to remember all sorts of things. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Remember just the Passover. Remember that you were slaves. Remember the stranger in your midst because you were strangers. And now what we're talking about is remember the Holocaust. But memory in Judaism is not an end unto itself. And it's not about dwelling in the past, nor is it an agenda item in and of itself. Really, every act of memory is attached to either an ethical or spiritual component. And so in remembering the Holocaust, the next words that should come to mind is never again. Mm. And never again is not about just the Jewish people. It's really that this kind of act of genocide should never be perpetrated against any people.
And I understand you also visited Rwanda and went to the Holocaust Museum in Kigali. Certainly what they went through was horrific.
And I was very moved by it because here in this small African nation, which is still in recovery from a horrific genocide, I walked into this museum, and of course they commemorated their own genocide, but then in successive rooms there was memorials to the other genocide, Armenian genocide, the Cambodian genocide, and of course the Jewish Holocaust as well. And that was really powerful in that it didn't totally focus just on themselves, but it focused on the act of genocide of one people against another and brought all of them together, and it was very, very powerful. And I kind of wish that we had that in there's so many Jewish museums commemorating the Holocaust, and I can't think of one of them that actually also shares the pain and suffering of other peoples. I wish there was.
Is there a theme this year?
It basically is that theme, but again, because of the uptick in anti-Semitic act, I think that's it's kind of becoming the focus of a lot of the commemorations of Yom HaShoah, as it's called in Hebrew. And there is both something good about that, and that it draws attention, but there's a danger in it as well, in equivocation, because what we're seeing today is an uptick in anti-Semitic actions, but we're not really seeing anti-Semitism. And I know that some people think I'm equivocating, but there really is a huge difference between what happened in Germany, where there was a systematic government-led genocide against the Jewish people versus the acts of individuals, which are largely condemned by law enforcement, and what we see in all of these horrific actions, the community coming together. I mean, after Pittsburgh, you know, Muslims, Christians all joined together. And after this latest attack in California, my imam friend called me to see if I was doing okay. That's not anti-Semitism anymore. This is the actions of haters. Dangerous tropes have kind of encouraged this kind of behavior, and it's worldwide, not just here in the United States.
We are seeing an uptick not only in anti-Semitism, but hate crimes here and in the U.S. and abroad. So these things certainly come to mind at times like this, and certainly never forget is a good motto, because we can't let ourselves forget and ever fall into anything that would be so horrific again.
Right. There is real danger, but the Holocaust was something that we can't forget, but we can't turn it into, oh, poor us, we always suffer, we're always the world's victim. I think that would miss the ethical commandment that lies in an awareness that all people, all minorities are in danger, and that we have to stand up for human rights wherever they are in danger.
All right, that is Rabbi Terry Buchman. He's author of the book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Rugby is one of Kenya's most popular sports, and the country's national team has played in the World Cup. Inspired by the national team's success, members of Kenya's deaf community launched a deaf rugby team last year. And that team, which has been training for just over a year now, has big dreams for the future. Sarah Kamani reports from Nairobi.
As the door slams behind him and Martin Kaisovia begins his journey to the rugby pitch, there's a rush of excitement in his eyes. He had played football as a child, but never played rugby until a year ago, when officials of the newly formed Kenya Deaf Rugby Association came to his church. Martin was born deaf and has largely remained within the deaf community in Kenya. For this story, he speaks to VOA through a sign language interpreter.
Before, when I was growing up, there was no deaf rugby. But I used to see that people like joining new things. Then I decided, let me go with the new thing.
At the pitch, about an hour's commute from his house, Martin joins 16 other players for practice. This has become the team's weekly Sunday afternoon routine. Maurice Okwach formed the team in the Kenya Deaf Rugby Association to support it. Speaking through a sign language interpreter, Okwach explains his motivation.
Kenya, we only, the people who are hearing are the ones who have a rugby team. So we thought, let's copy South Africa also. Let's form our team.
Deaf rugby is also played in Australia, Canada and England, and the sport is represented at the Deaf Olympics, which comes up next in 2021. The players in Nairobi haven't played a game yet and don't have a sponsor. They make do with what they have, one ball and mismatched second-hand uniforms. Okwach says the team is currently self-supporting.
When we formed this group, I tried to look for funding, but it was very difficult. And the committee, ourselves, we decided let's first of all chip in. So we chipped in, we bought a ball as a committee.
There's no whistle here. The team's coach, Brennan Rashid, communicates with players through sign language. In a professional deaf rugby match, the referee waves a white flag to draw the attention of the players. Unlike the players, Rashid is not deaf. He says that despite a lack of playing experience, the team is getting better.
I have seen the progress. I've seen them taking it step by step, going places with it. I have seen them getting a proper understanding of the game, and that's just the best thing that I can give.
Despite the various hardships, Kasuvia and the other players have big dreams, like competing in the Deaf Olympics. He says his goal is to win the gold. Sarah Kemani for VOA News, Nairobi.
Well, in music news, 6 years after their split, the reunited American pop band trio, the Jonas Brothers, have announced a 40-date tour to promote the upcoming release of their newest album, Happiness Begins.
Hey guys, what's up?
What's up, everybody?
We are so beyond excited to share this news with you. June 7th, our album Happiness Begins comes out.
Our first album ever. It's going to be insane. We've worked so incredibly hard on this.
Making sure that we brought you all the joy and happiness you bring us every day. So thank you. Can't wait for you to hear it.
Some of my favorite songs, number 7 and number 10.
Well, the album will be the fifth, their fifth, but the first since 2009.
We go together, better than birds of a feather, you and me, we change the weather.
Formed in 2005, the group gained popularity from their appearances on the Disney Channel television network. They sold over 17 million albums worldwide. The new release, Sucker, became the 34th song in history to debut at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and became the Jonas Brothers' first number one single on the charts. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Yeah. 'Cause I know you and you know everything about me. I can't remember all of the nights I don't remember when you're around me. I've been dancing on top of cars and stumbling out of bars. I follow you through the dark, can't get enough. You're the medicine and the pain, the tattoo inside my brain. And baby, you know it's obvious. I'm a sucker for you. Say the word and I'll go anywhere blindly. I'm a sucker for you. Yeah. Any road you take, you know that you'll find me. I'm a sucker for all. And stumbling out of bars, I follow you through the dark, can't get enough. You're the medicine and the pain, the tattoo inside my brain. And maybe you know it's obvious. I'm a sucker for you. Yeah. Say the word and I'll go anywhere blindly. I'm a sucker for you. I'm
sucker for you.